Our next speaker, Andy Moyer, has been a member of ARSC for most of the last 15 years, and this is his fourth conference. Andy has a degree in music education. He has hosted on-air shows of classical, big band, and country music, and for a number of years now has been the audio-video producer for an insurance association outside of Washington, D.C. Andy has been a collector since childhood. His collection spans many musical interests and recording formats, but it leans heavily toward 78s and classical music. And Andy's presentation this morning is titled, When is a Junk Record Really Junk? Reassembling Operas from the Acoustical Era. Andy Moyer.
Just a second here. I have a friend, Bill, who I've known for about 25 years. Great personality, well-read, intelligent, but he's not a collector like me. So all the time and effort put into trying to establish records as an archive, he just doesn't get it. So last year, I told him proudly that after about 10 years of searching, I managed to put together my copy of the Gramophone's 1908 Carmen with Emmy Destin in the title role. This is 18 discs from 1908, and this is the amalgamation of searching over countless hours of auction lists and eBay and bartering with dealers and paying for shipping and fighting with customs and praying to the mailing gods that their gorillas were gentle that week. Anyway, there it is. I finally managed to put it together. And he said, but I thought you already had this on CD. Okay, yeah, but I was trying to go for the actual artifact. So I told him, I was so proud of this idea that I had to explain to him, I only knew of three other copies of this thing that existed, one of which sold at auction for almost $3,300 about 5 years ago. And I'm sure with all the other archives and private collections, there have to be more copies of this thing in existence, but I don't know of them. Anyway, he said, so you spent 8 years or 10 years putting a dodo or bringing a dodo back to life. And I said, well, how do you mean this? And he said, well, like a good paleontologist, you recovered all the parts and you put it back together and you recreated an endangered species and you brought it one step further away from extinction. And I thought, well, what an astute way of looking at exactly what I was trying to accomplish by trying to be a collector. And he said, so how much are you going to sell your copy for? I was like, okay, fine, all right. Well, this is sort of the whole gist of this idea of collectors and archivists is trying to bring some of these dodos back to life again. The individual single records is one thing, but an album set like this from so long ago is much more difficult. When I was collecting this one, I was also collecting the Marguerite, the German version of Faust, which came out the same year, again with Emmy Destin. But when I bought a record off of an auction and it showed up on my doorstep with a label looking like that, there's no demarcation whatsoever of an album or a side number to it whatsoever. So I realized how many of these things had I passed over arbitrarily as Flotsam and Jetsam, and thinking, okay, then that does beg the question, when is a junk record really a junk record? And the collectors in this room will get the jokes of these, possibly, but we're all we're entitled to our opinions, right? Anyway, here's another example. Now, Franz Nabl was a German tenor, was well known, and this is a moderately interesting thing to an opera collector, but no great shakes. Here's the backside of it. Now, certainly, unless you're doing a discography on black label, seal, Victor, foreign pressings or foreign import recordings, an acoustically recorded 4-minute truncated version of what should be an 8.5-minute opera overture by a nondescript orchestra without even a conductor listed would probably be passed over. But if you pay attention to the matrix number, this is actually side one of a 28-side set of the Fledermaus, which was issued the year prior to the Marguerite and the Carmen sets. So now you can go back and you think, well, maybe that was something that you should have paid attention to. So trying to find these sets in their entirety is not that easy. Anyway, also, if you bought this transfer of this CD, which was actually a very good transfer by Prizer, it lacks this overture because the set lasts a little bit longer than one CD, and rather than issuing a two CD set, they left it off, which also negates the integrity of the set as it was originally intended for the audience to hear in 1907. To the average listener of today, the recordings of the acoustic era on a whole are a little bit more than a charming glimpses of a distant time, and they're usually hampered by mist of intrusive hiss and a very narrow range of dynamics. I don't mean to belittle my subject from the get-go, but seriously, an entire opera in these conditions in 1 to 2 minute segments is not necessarily a pastime for everybody. It's sort of like alligator wrestling, you know, nice concept, but who the hell wants to do it? And yet, during the first quarter of the century, despite these extremely limited dynamic ranges, almost absurd conditions under which the musicians had to endure in the studio, and the primitive means in which to reproduce them even, the act of preserving these large works on wax and issuing them to the general public actually happened, again, like alligator wrestling with astonishing regularity. No less than 52 operas with more or less consistent casts and 16 abridged or potted sets exist, as well as three acts from Wagner operas. Now, for the purist, I'll clarify, there are a lot of operettas here. There's Gilbert and Sullivan as well. So, and there's also 17 abridged sets if you include an abridged version of Handel's Messiah from 1906. So the question as to why these sets were done is pretty obvious. It was all the means of reproduction of sound that they had at the time. But why should we care today? Well, actually, these relics of a recorded past were more often or not provide us with the best window, albeit slightly opaque, into the opera houses of the world during the first quarter of the century. And the performers included in these sets may not have been top artisans of their trade, but on some level that adds to the performance's authenticity of the time. And many of these sets have a ringer or a star in the title role or the next, you know, top two roles. But on the whole, the cast was usually chosen either out of availability or cost, or reliable performances in the studio. In other words, they gave good horn. Anyway, also, I have to keep going, sorry. Also, most of these performers lived within a generation and in many cases were contemporaries of the composers who actually wrote these masterworks. So they have a first-hand or near first-hand connection with the performance practices of the time in which these masterpieces were written. The most frustrating thing about these primitive sets, these hernia-inducing sets, is finding them intact or even trying to reassemble them. And in most instances, the single biggest obstacle to overcome are the record companies themselves. The changes in catalog numbers, label design, disc size, format, as well as a complete lack of reference to a set or side number, as I said earlier, have all been reasons and causes for sending these sets into the wind and being dispersed. And one of the primary examples would be the Pagliacci set, which has been well documented, and I know this is sort of repetitive to be talking about it here, but it's a primary example of what I'm trying to get across. Now, this was recorded in the Milan branch of Gramophone and Typewriters Company. In 1907, Leon Cavallo, the composer, was actually present during the rehearsals or recordings, despite G&T's claiming that he actually conducted it, is negated, probably if for no other reason, by the publicity shots where Leon Cavallo is shown with the cast, but he's also always standing next to the house conductor, Carlos Sabagno. So that's kind of difficult. I question why he would be there if he wasn't part of the act. Anyway, regardless, Leon Cavallo still had his virtual thumbprint on these recordings, and it's a very convincing performance from start to finish. When it was first released, It was released on G&T's label with no demarcation of set or side number. You had to find it in their catalog. And if you don't have the catalog, you don't know what you're looking for. And as you can see, here is the list of how they showed up, the catalog numbers. These were all single-sided. And many of you have a working knowledge of Gramophone's catalog numbering system. It has a lot more to do with category than it does an overarching numerical system for their catalog. If it starts with a zero, it's a 12-inch. Without the zero, it's a 10-inch. The next number over denotes where it was recorded. This is 5, so it was from Italy. It was 4, it was Germany, et cetera. The next number over tells you what the ensemble is. So in the first one, it's a 12-inch from Milan, and it's a solo male singer, in this case a baritone. And this is the 163rd disc from that category. So obviously there's no numerical order to this. Now, the title role, the canio, the pagliacci of our little drama, was actually sung by the Cuban tenor Antonio Paoli, and he was a Red Seal artist, and he shows up on these 7 discs. So now you've got a mixture of Red and Black Seal as well. And because of the expense of Red Seal discs at the time that this was issued, Gramophone understood that process, and they realized that this is going to be an expensive set, so they brought in a Black Seal recording artist by the name of Barbaini, and he re-recorded these 5 sides. So you have, depending on what your wallet would allow, it was up to you to decide what clown you wanted to listen to. Sort of like voting in the primaries, isn't it? thank you. I'm here all night. So the following year, it was brought to the United States. And it was gracious that Victor actually marked that it was a series, and they actually marked the side numbers. However, they didn't bring all of it with them. They only brought most of it. And they also only brought 2 of the Barbainis if you wanted a cheaper version of it. Now, as you see, there's no side 11, and that was because that is Veste La Giuba, the big solo number from the set, and they wanted you to buy Caruso's domestically recorded version, which is that number, which also never showed up with any kind of demarcation for a set, so you had to know what you were going for. Even the 1908 booklet that came out from Victor shows that you could buy one other domestically recorded version of this, as well as digging back into their catalog for the 10-inch version of Caruso's solo. Anyway, if that wasn't bad enough, about a year later, Victor doubled all of their Black Seal sides, their domestic records, and they recataloged everything. So the new numbering system looks like this. And also, they wanted you to continue with the Caruso side, so there's that. And then they started a foreign catalog, and that, since these originated from Milan, they renumbered it yet again in another 2 or 3 years. So now you've got all these different variances to choose from, and then in 23, they doubled their Red Seal, so the last 2 straggling Paoli sides end up on that disc. And if you want to add insult to injury, don't forget, in England, this is what was going on in HMV with theirs, and they started doubling their side. Anyway, so you get the idea. This is not an isolated case. Going back to Gramophone and going back to the Fledermaus set, in 1907, 8, and 9, Gramophone actually issued a number of different sets, including those 3, the Carmen Faust and the Fledermaus. They also issued, Walser Traum and Gypsy Baron, as well as the Merry Widow. And the four operettas in this series fall under a different category because they graciously kept the numbering system for the 2 operas the same. When they first issued the Fledermaus, the labels looked like this. They did have demarcations right below the spindle hole. This was set A, not a number, but a letter. And this is side 17 from the set. And here are the numbers of the catalogs in playing order. Now, once you start getting beyond this, after about two or three years after it was issued, they dropped it down to their green label, cheaper issues, and it got renumbered under that category. And the labels looked like this. Now, Actually, there is a demarcation, but you have to really look for it. It's there. And that only lasted for another year or so, because after this, when they started getting away from the single-sided one catalog number per disc, they actually combined everything and started putting a catalog number per disc, but both sides inclusive, and they renumbered it again. Now, you'll notice also that it's not the same catalog number for the first two sides or the next two sides. That's because if you had access to two turntables, you could play this entire set as well as the other sets in this series without interruption. That's because no two consecutive sides appeared on the same disc. And if you want a road map as to where to find them, there you go. Which also adds to the problem that if you find one of these records without the demarcation anymore, it still leads to that idea that this is just two random selections from one opera and not part of a set. This is also not isolated to just Gramophone. I know we've been picking on them. Odeon issued their sets twice over with different labels, different number category. And then we have Pathé, who also from 1911 to 1913 issued the first of their nine opera sets on convenient 14-inch center start Hillendale discs that spun at approximately 90 RPM. And these two were issued in two ways because they had their own machine, the Pathephone Duplex, which was two turntables in one, so you could buy the sets either this way so that you had sides 1 and 3, 2 and 4, 5 and 7, et cetera, or you can get the set if you only had one turntable, and you can get a more standard version. So these were issued almost contemporaneously, so you had to make sure if you weren't mixing them up. Later on, they started issuing their sets on more traditional 11.5, still Hillendale, but outside start with a paper label. And they also started including the names of the performers on their label for a change. But they also issued them with variations. This is all from the Faust set that they came out with. They also issued two more operas at that time period. Phonotypia also issued two extensive excerpts from two operas, but had no demarcations whatsoever. The Milan and Paris branches of Gramophone did the same thing with other sets that they had, so they're kind of scattered to the wind. We'll get to this in a second. The thing is that electronic discographies really offer us as collectors and archivists a great advantage because we can sort by composer, by performer, by matrix number, and it allows us to see systems or patterns in the chaos that we wouldn't see if we were paging through them individually. And I put this test to a theory, or put this theory to a test, one of these other way around, with an electronic version of Alan Kelly's discography of the French branch of the G&T and Gramophone Company. At that time period, at the turn of the century, Faust, again, was extremely popular, and their catalog was rife with different recordings. And when I started pulling up Faust recordings from their catalog, I was surprised to see that these three artists wound up showing up over and over and over. They were brought back into the studio in 1905, 1907, and 1910. And indeed, Bale and Gressa were the Faust and Mephistopheles in the Pathé version. Anyway, when these started showing up, they were kind of varied in the second two, in the 1907 and 1910 issues, but the 1905, they were very consistent in showing up all within 1 year. And when you started looking at some of the larger ensembles, these three names started showing up. So I went back and looked up for any solo works or duet works from those two, or those three names, and came up with more names that also fit in with the same category of matrix numbers, all within the same year of 1905. Then started looking around for chorus works, which have to come in this opera, and that added two more sides. Now we've got a conductor, and then I started thinking about the history of Faust, which was that it couldn't be played at the Paris Opera until Gounod complied with the regulations of the time, which it had to include a ballet. This is a French recording. Where's the ballet? Ta-da! Six more sides, and we've got a complete ballet, and it again falls neatly within the matrix system. So several of these sides were actually reissued on Zonophone and doubled, and those show up with extra numbers on the side. And when I found two of the Gressa solos, this is the same recording, just the different issues. When the Zonophone disc showed up at my house, the backside was the very next matrix number, again, yet another solo from Gressa, from Faust, which I had no discovery of or no documentation whatsoever in the G&T catalog. So that added one more. Now we've got this entire set from 1905. None of it has any markings. Well, what I've found of it, I've only got nine so far. None of it has any demarcation of set or intention or anything of that sort. But it's very difficult to ignore within 1,000 matrix numbers and all within the same year, this many records from the same opera, all with the same cast. Now, coming up with the last year or last thing here, this presentation I know has been focused on operas of the Western culture, but there are any number of zarzuela and Chinese opera sets and Armenian operetta, which were actually issued in this country, and musical theater from England and Germany and France, and plays and instructional sets for languages and how to sing and exercise. All of these, even in spite of demarcations on the label for set or side number, have been scattered to the winds as well. And I know I'm not being original in doing a very specific area of this kind of discography. You know, Bauer gave us a good start. Richter really put it on the map. And if it has an instrumental recording in the opera, there's a good chance that Arnold mentioned it in or footnoted it in his discography of the orchestra, acoustically recorded orchestra, which I did find these opera or the ballet from this set in his book, but there was no mention of the rest of this in his book. Generally speaking, a lot of those discographies do talk about these sets, but only in their first incarnation. They don't talk about the recataloging. They don't talk about the relabeling. And if I hadn't come across that Zonophone, I never would have found that. So that's where this really becomes crucial in the discographies, to include all the variants and all the other catalog numbers that correspond with these things. If we're going to try to reassemble some of these sets, a lot of them have been lovingly restored on CD, I grant you that, but there's still a lot of them out there that are still floating around or haven't even been discovered like this, or haven't even been put back together and reissued. But if we're ever going to do that, we probably need a lot of those alternative catalog numbers in order to succeed. Maybe they don't even exist in their original form anymore. Anyway, this again plays off of what Steve was talking about, that we really need to be as thorough as possible with all of our discographies, and there needs to be something done along this line as well. Thank you.
We have plenty of time for questions.
No, we don't.
It says 12:30 here. Yes.
The comment set that you showed on the screen.
Oh.
It looks to me here that amongst the 12-inch records, there was a 10-inch one. Did they really give you different sizes?
Oh, yes, yes. The idea of issuing different size discs within one set was very common, and it didn't deteriorate, but it continued all the way up until the LP era, but it really tapered off substantially around about 1925, 1921. But yes, and as a matter of fact, this will take a moment because it was very far in the beginning, but on the Fledermaus, you'll notice that there was 12-inch, 10-inch, and one straggling, there it goes, 7-inch down in the corner. This is the same thing that happened with Merry Widow. As a matter of fact, this is a fate. I have most of the set, but I don't have the 7-inch, and I'm missing one or two of the 12-inch. But the 7-inch there is actually from The Merry Widow, and it's the only two sides, and they're almost all dialogue. That's the other thing, too, about the operettas from these this series in particular, which is interesting. They actually included dialogue to keep the storyline. It's not just the music, which was something that also didn't happen very often until the LP era. Anything else?
Other questions?
Oh, God. Help me.
Although I am interested in the records, I am interested in the album covers even more. And I had a quick shot of the Carmen from a screen grab of a TV show in my album cover story. Are there other albums that were put out other than those six from this series? And then the gramophone stuff in 1917, 18, and 19?
The one that I believe that Odeon used original albums, but they were just generic covers. It just had a medallion with the Odeon design on it. At least to my knowledge, I don't know. I might be wrong. Does it say Tannhäuser? Okay, that one I haven't seen yet. So, as a matter of fact, now we can scroll all the way back down here. That one advertisement that you saw kind of gives you a good idea.
I love that. That is a great ad.
And
Steinweiss did not invent the album cover.
Pardon me?
Steinweiss did not invent the album cover.
No, he did not. And these aren't Goldberg designs either, but anything else? Yes.
How are these sold in the shops? Could you have bought the album empty? Could you have bought the album empty and filled it with discs? Or?
My assumption is that was probably the case. And what I do know is that a lot of these sets were actually sold completely individually, and they weren't in. As I said, you had to buy the catalog, or you had to have the catalog and know what discs you were actually buying. So you had to go back and get each one, and that was also sort of the problem with these sets being incomplete a lot of the times, because they go and buy the famous arias. They wouldn't buy that connective tissue monologue or dialogue in between, so those become far more difficult to get a hold of. And on the whole, acoustically recorded opera, generally speaking, if it's an instrumental from that opera, it's not going to show up near as frequently as the arias are. So even the instrumental, like the ballet set, I seriously doubt I'm going to be able to find that. I would love to, but I'm chancing that it's going to be a long, hard search. I'm sorry. Go ahead. You got a mic.
A series of quick questions about the discographic integrity of the CD reissues that you've listened to. Mm-hmm. Have most of them had integrity that all of the records they've been taken from have been from a single edition of the vinyl, or have you discovered instances where they've been broken and you found a side that's been taken from a different edition?
Well, generally speaking, if they're trying to reissue this on a CD, they try to. I've known people who have like two and three and four sets, not necessarily of these, but when they can get access to multiple sets, they take the best copy that they can possibly get from each one of them. So it may not be the primary issue. It may be, several different issues at the same time. That's where it gets tricky, too, where you have matrix numbers that may have been take one versus take two, and there are cases like that. Some of the Odeon sides are alternate takes. So there's that choice. Do you take the primary matrix number if it sounds horrible and it looks like a doormat before you play it, or do you take the cleaner copy and just say that this is take two and just ignore the first one? But generally speaking, they will try to use whatever best copy they've got, depending, as long as it's the original music.
Well, you gave the one example where the additions over time, over about 15 years, tended to be fairly radically different by the time you got to the end of the time string. Was that the exception and not the rule?
I'm not sure I understand.
Where on the HMV series, there were the Crusoes were substituted sides were not dropped.
When they're substituted size, generally speaking, they try to go for the absolute true original intended set.
Then did they usually go for the first issue?
Yes.
That was issued?
Yeah. Then I got you, yes.
When you were showing that, the previous slide you had up there, which had all the records splayed out beside the album, you're saying that they weren't all the right records for that album?
No, that 7-inch was actually the Merry Widow.
Yeah, because also the second 12-inch went up had a run-on groove, which none of the rest of them had.
Yeah, right.
Well, people are going to look at that. And they're gonna,
sure am I. Well, this was just supposed to be up there for 2 seconds. We weren't supposed to dwell on that.
I'm just very interested to find out if there's ways of putting out your needs for, I need this side, or I'm looking for this random thing. And I know that there have been various projects like that in the past, but you know, I think of all these record sales that, I mean, if you're looking for that one diamond or something, and that we could help out if... I say we being libraries and archives and all that.
I would love to create some sort of a pool, as it were, that people could put in their stray copies of whatever they've got from sets that people could go to and say, oh, yeah, I need this one if you've got it, and then be able to walk with that without having to buy one whole other set that's maybe missing two other records or something and combining. But, yeah, that would be wonderful. The other problem, though, too, is that, just like I was saying, without the demarcations of the label, we don't always know that this actually belongs to a set, so people aren't necessarily going to put them in the pool for people to find. So there is going to be that problem. Yep.
This is really a question for everybody, and maybe it'll be a question that makes people uncomfortable, and I don't mean that, but I'm just curious.
Where are you going with this?
No. For those collectors and or archives and libraries, if you come across incomplete collections of things, I know that depending on what the donor asked you to do, you know, you're beholden to keep it, whether it's incomplete or broken or whatever. Sometimes those things have no strings attached where you can put them in a book sale, you know, a record sale. Just like it's an incomplete, but here are some discs of this thing. And I'm just wondering if people who have collections, who have extras or incomplete things, how do you handle that? Nobody's saying you're throwing them away or burning them. So I just want to ask about that.
Having a set burning. Any comments?
Hundreds and hundreds of duplicates, man. Can you
keep
them? Throw them away?
Oh, you're going to throw them?
Oh,
yeah.
No.
Give them to Andy.
I'm great.
My house is going to be like...
No, I...
Well,
the problem is with such a fruit catch, you're going to get an awful lot of rocks and very few diamonds.
Very true. Anyway. Any other questions for Steve, too? Or...
Hi, fascinating. Bill Moran had a copy of the Faust set, that the blue-covered gramophone set, which is now at the UCSB library. And when I first looked at it, I was completely befuddled because some of the labels say Shaw Platen gramophone, some of them say gramophone concert record. They're different sizes, they're different colors.
Right.
And I don't know whether he assembled it after the fact. You know, maybe he found the album with a couple of records, and then he spent 50 years completing it, or whether he found it in the wild like that. I don't really know, and maybe somebody who knew Bill better than I did would know, but that's the only one I've ever seen of these.
Well, you have to realize, too, that these were issued all throughout Europe, so they came out on their gramophone equivalent, and that's why you have the different titles across the top. The best way to find out, if you want, I can give you a listing to make sure that you've got the right catalog numbers, and you can go from there and make sure that it's accurate, that he didn't just settle for, I mean, it sounds like he did a good job of it, but it may be that if there was one section missing, that he just grabbed what he could that was contemporaneous of that by maybe another artist, but
yeah, and I don't know whether he put it together, or whether somebody yeah. else, or whether it was how it was done. So,
well, another thing too about the Faust set is that actually it was recorded collectively within about 3 months in the beginning of 1908, but the one aria by Carl Jorn from the third act was actually recorded in 1906, I believe, and issued as a single side. So that it has a completely different catalog number that even predates the set. So they wound up incorporating that. I don't know if he felt like he didn't need to be recorded again. It's actually a very nice job. But, I can give you a list of catalog numbers. You can make sure that you got it right. But just because the labels are different doesn't mean that it isn't an accurate set.
Right. Our copy is in OCLC. If anybody wants to look at all the catalog numbers and matrix numbers, it's all in there. So. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Anybody else?
I have just a comment. I'm sure some of you have collectors have found the same thing. One of the causes of incomplete sets is the mixing of sizes within a set. Because if you have two 12-inch records on either side of a 10, the 12s are prone to breaking. All it takes is a slight amount of pressure on the top of that album, and they're gone. John.
I take records out of albums and save the album as a separate artifact because of exactly what you're talking about. Usually it's the first record in an album that falls into the seam when you open the album because the glue has deteriorated. Yeah. The record has a smile in it. So I advise all of you to take the records out of albums, put them in separate sleeves, put the album somewhere safe.
Also, after 100 plus years and 18 pounds of records, cardboard, fabric, paper, it doesn't hold up very well. So you actually preserve the album. Of course, you need much more shelf space, but you do preserve the album better without the records in it. But anyway.
Any other questions? Or for Steve? Thank you both for an excellent session.